Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. A hunger strike is underway by prisoners at Marquette Prison in Michigan, where the Reverend Edward Pinckney is wrongfully imprisoned. We speak to Reverend Pinckney to get an update. And in Iraq, violence escalates as a battle to retake Fallujah from ISIS is underway, with Iran-trained Iraqi government forces backed by bombardment by U.S. air power. Also, peace talks in Syria have broken down. What is the impact of the history in the region and the role that Western powers played in redrawing borders in the Middle East, in particular the Sykes-Picot Agreement, with conflicts happening in the region today? Our guest is Jim Paul, author of Syria Unmasked and former executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and the U.S. presidential race, turmoil in the DNC as thousands call for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to be ousted as leader of the DNC. We speak with Howie Klein, who blogs at Down with Tyranny website. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The United Nations Refugee Agency says at least 880 refugees and migrants died trying to cross the Mediterranean last week. The UNHCR said this year is proving to be particularly deadly, with more than 2,500 people dying in shipwrecks or when their boats capsized so far this year. A spokesman said smugglers are packing people on boats that are barely seaworthy and in many cases are not meant to make the crossing. He said the drownings underline the importance of rescue operations and the need for real, safer alternatives for people needing international protection. Former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says whistleblower Edward Snowden performed a public service in stoking a national debate about secret domestic surveillance programs, but that he should still return to the U.S. to stand trial.
We can certainly argue about the way in which Snowden did what he did, but I think that he actually performed a public service by raising the debate. I think there has to be a consequence for what he has done. But I think, you know, in deciding what an appropriate sentence should be, I think a judge could take into account the usefulness of having had that national debate.
As a National Security Agency contractor, Snowden leaked details in 2013 of massive U.S. government warrant surveillance programs. He now lives in Russia and faces U.S. charges that could land him in prison for up to 30 years. Holder spoke with CNN political commentator David Axelrod in a podcast. A federal judge holds a hearing today to examine ways to address Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio's contempt of court violations in a racial profiling case. The Maricopa County Sheriff was found in civil contempt 2 weeks ago for disobeying court orders in the profiling case, including letting his immigration patrols continue after the judge ordered them stopped. The finding is expected to bring greater court oversight to the sheriff's office. It could also lead to a criminal contempt case that could result in fines or even jail time for Arpaio. Arpaio has been campaigning with Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. A crowd estimated at up to 30,000 people turned out to see Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders in downtown Oakland for a Memorial Day rally. Corinne Smith was there.
It was a holiday crowd, estimated at over 30,000 people, that welcomed Sanders to Oakland on Memorial Day.
So many candidates are beholden to political interests and to their funders, and I don't see him playing those political games. I see that he really truly believes in Medicare for all, and he really truly believes in immigrant rights, and he really truly believes in the importance of free access to education.
The crowd was spirited yet attentive as Bernie Sanders took the stage. He gave a rousing speech. One of the loudest cheers from the crowd was to applaud the call for more action in the face of climate change.
We have a moral responsibility as custodians of this planet to make sure that we leave this planet in a way that is healthy for our kids.
Californians will cast their vote in the Democratic primary next Tuesday. In Oakland, I'm Corinne Smith, KPFA Pacifica.
After the Oakland rally, Sanders and actor and activist Danny Glover arrived at the Oracle Arena during halftime to see the Golden State Warriors achieve a come-from-behind victory to clinch a spot in the NBA Finals. Afterwards, Sanders tweeted, "Last week, Golden State was down 3-1. Tonight, they finished off a great comeback in California. I like comebacks." North Korea attempted to fire an intermediate-range missile from its east coast, but the launch appears to have failed. That's according to South Korean officials. North Korea unsuccessfully attempted 3 test launches of the missile in April in defiance of United Nations Security Council resolutions banning such launches. China, which is the North's only major ally, called for an end to any action that would exacerbate tension. In March, China agreed to tough UN sanctions against North Korea. Groups working for peace on the Korean Peninsula note the U.S. and North Korea are still technically at war, a legacy of the Korean War of the 1950s. They say that until there's a peace treaty between the U.S. and the North, North Korea will continue to build its nuclear and conventional military arsenals. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. The Reverend Edward Pinckney is a leader of the Black Autonomy Network community organization based in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Benton Harbor is a majority Black town with lakefront property. And the Reverend Edward Pinckney and his wife, Dorothy, for decades have waged a fight against racism, against Whirlpool Corporation, whose international headquarters is in Benton Harbor. And they have basically been doing a land grab in Benton Harbor, among other problems. Also, the city was under the emergency managership established by the governor at the time in Michigan, and the Reverend Edward Pinckney fought against that and was the first to warn people of this emergency management of cities. And we saw one result in Flint, Michigan, where the governor appointed an emergency manager who switched the city's water to the filthy Flint River, poisoning a whole city and a generation of children. Now, the powers that be have been after the Reverend Edward Pinckney for many years. He was previously spent time in prison on a trumped-up charge of voter fraud. There was a whole campaign, a national and international campaign, to free the Reverend Edward Pinckney, and he went right back to Benton Harbor, where he continued to agitate against racism, for the environment, and for human rights. And he was yet again, basically found guilty again. It's almost like the same playbook of a trumped up charge of election fraud. And the Reverend Edward Pinckney is now in prison, and he is in a very isolated prison over 500 miles from his family and supporters. And there's a hunger strike going on at Marquette Prison, where Reverend Pinckney is based. Reverend Pinckney speaking to him directly from Marquette Prison. Reverend Pinckney, welcome back to Sojourner Truth.
Margaret Prescott, thank you so much for having me. And I'm calling you directly from Marquette Branch Prison, which is the concentration camp of America. I tell you, we had one of the greatest protesters that ever been exhibited in the history of the prison system. Over 700 people out of a total of 800 people refused to go to the chow hall. It was so incredible, because we are sick and tired of the food that they've been distributing to us. The food is rotten, it's spoiled, it has a rodent waste in it. And it also has what you call magnets, worms, and bugs. They constantly serving us food that is not that nobody was served to anybody. So we said enough is enough, and we decided not to go. And we've been fighting this thing, and the retaliation by the warden himself, he had everybody locked down all day. And but that didn't, that's all part of it. Any time that you do any kind of resistance, you know you got to expect some kind of consequences from the power to be. So what they did, they locked everybody down. Then just recently they moved everybody. They switched sales, one person to another, anything to distract you. But, you know, it comes with the territory. That's what we have to understand. Everything comes with the territory, and that's what we're fighting now. And we, believe me, it's been something, Margaret, that you would not believe. You would not believe all the stuff that goes on here and all the stuff they have done to me. They have did everything they could think of to me. They even had my phone cut off for 180 days, claiming I made a three-way call, but it was only a conference call. And they cut my phone off for 180 days because if they say that you made a three-way call, you made a three-way call. Mm. Then they tried to get me, tried to cut my visitors off. What they did, they claimed that I was trying to smuggle something out of the prison system, knowing that it was impossible for me to be at the front gate during this period of time. And then every chance they have gotten, they have done something to me, you know. But getting still, I'm still standing. Recently, I had a visit, and I had to use the bathroom. And they refused to allow me to use the bathroom. They wanted me to use a bathroom that was broken. And it says right on there, broken, do not use. But they wanted me to use it. And then if it was overflow or something like that, then they would have forced me to clean it up, or they would have took me to the hole or did something to me, and I refused to do it. But I'm still fighting. Margaret, I'm telling you, this has been quite a fight that, you know, that people need to understand that it's the prison system, it's the taxpayer money, and what they're doing to the taxpayer is robbery. They're stealing from the taxpayer by overcharging them and then giving people this food that nobody should be eating. But I also have some kind of good news for you.
Okay.
Which is not all bad. Recently, we went to the Court of Appeals in Grand Rapids. And they put my case. Well, here's what they said. First, the prosecutor said that you don't need evidence to send Reverend Pinckney to prison. He told the jury that. Then the judge echoed pretty much the same thing. The judge echoed, whatever decision you make as jurors is going to be final, that it won't be overturned. And then we get to the Court of Appeal. One of the three judges said, I'm not interested in whether there was enough evidence to convict this man. I care less about that. And Yentil, but the good news is we get a chance to expose them for who they really are. I don't mind doing this time if it's going to make some changes. So, Margaret, my goal is to be here, even if I have to suffer, but continue to fight this battle and win this battle. So I'm here, but my heart is right there with everybody all around the country, fighting, standing up, showing people what we can do if we stand up and fight together, because it's all about the people. It's not about me. It's not about anything that's basically going on in Benton Harbor. It's about everything that's going on in the country. It's the system. You see, you'll never hear about me being on Oprah Winfrey show. Never. She'll never interview me. She believed that this system is not corrupt. She believed that the establishment is not corrupt. She believed that the criminal justice system is fair to all. But I'm here to tell you, Oprah Winfrey, you're hearing it from my lips. This system is corrupt. The establishment is corrupt. And listen to this. The criminal justice system is about as corrupt as you can get. And they do not rehabilitate you in the prison system. And that's what I have to tell you today.
Reverend Pinckney, we know that your time is very limited. That's why I really just wanted you to say as much as you can fit in before they cut you off. About how many more minutes do you have, Reverend Pinckney?
I probably got about 3 minutes.
About 3 minutes. Okay. So in the 3 minutes, I mean, we're hearing that Heidi Washington, director of the Michigan Department of Corrections, and Robert Napel, the Marquette warden, that they're refusing to force the prison to serve a proper diet for the prisoners. Just give us your last word here. Clearly, they're after you because you have been such a fighter. You've been such an organizer. And you're right, because mainstream media that they all should be covering your work and what is going on also at Marquette Prison. Final words, Reverend Pinckney.
Absolutely. You see what they're doing now, because here's the thing. When people don't go eat, the Trinity Food Service have already gotten paid for serving the prisoners. You see, now what they're trying to do now, they're trying to force them to return that money, that $700. So it's a double kickback. It's a benefit for the prison system now. Remember this, it's a benefit for them. It's Heidi Washington and Robert DePell, all of them. It's a benefit for these people for doing this. But here's the thing. We got to continue this fight and show the people what we can do and how we can win this fight. And 700 people have never came together on the unification. They was unified. It was all one voice, one term. Everybody was speaking. Everybody did it as an individual, because in a prison you can't have no leaders, no nothing. You have to have everybody got to do it as an individual. It was done individually. And one of the guys came up to me and told me that you have been an inspiration to this whole prison system. He said we would have never, ever had the heart and the guts to do it and fight the way you fight and join this thing and do this thing, because he said somebody has to stand up for the people. Somebody has to do what's right. And he said, Reverend Pinckney, you have been chosen our man. We will never, ever forget me. Matter of fact, we got billboards all over the city of Benton Harbor now. Stop the Crusher in Barron County. One of the parents, the guys here, parents, want to put up some billboards here in Marquette to show how the prison system is being operated and how they're taking taxpayers' dollars. So, I told him, hey, that's going to be on you. You take care of your business. We need to do what we need to do. We need to stay focused and do the things that need to be done. And here's, Margaret, here's what's important. We, not only in here, have to unify, but the people out there, we can do very little in here because they got it under the control system. But the people out there, see, we have to fight them from the outside in, not from the inside out. It got to be from the outside in. That's how we're going to win this battle, Margaret. And I can almost guarantee you that this is not going to be the end. And matter of fact, I have been on a hunger strike. I will not eat until there's some justice done here at Marquette Branch Prison. And just to let you know that it's been 7 days now, and I just drink a little water, drink a little juice, and just keep myself healthy enough and make sure something is done. And it's what you call a complete hunger strike. Other people want to join in, but they got, like I told them, anything you do as an individual. Don't do it because of me. You do it as an individual. I'm going to make sure that's clear, because you cannot operate under those terms.
And Reverend Pinckney, we, of course, are concerned about your health. I mean, you've been an incredible leader on the outside of prison in Benton Harbor and actually on the inside. If you've got a quick minute, Reverend Pinckney, you were one of the first complaining about this emergency management system put in place by the governor of Michigan. And now we see one result in the poisoning of Flint in that water crisis. A quick comment.
Absolutely, and it's really, that's the beginning, because they start poisoning us.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Harbor. They started, but we fought back. We wasn't having it. Whirlpool Corporation was stealing water to water the golf court, the Jack Nicklaus signature golf court. They were stealing water. They sliced into the water supply line, and they poisoned the water by doing that, by letting the chemicals from the golf court flow into the water, and it flowed in the water, and the people in the city of Benton Harbor were drinking. But we fought back. We made them repair all that, but they refused to pay the water bill. But on that note, the emergency manager is a dictator, but we, the people, must stand together. We must stand together and fight back.
Right.
We can do this. We can do this. And if you want to get in touch with Reverend Pinckney, you can call my wife at 269-925-0001, and she can tell you how you can help us.
Right, and we're going to be talking with Joe Perry, the spokesperson for the movement to free Reverend Pinckney. We'll be talking with him next. Reverend Pinckney, stay well, keep us posted, and we'll have
you
back on the air.
Yeah.
cut off by prison authorities. Reverend Edward Pinckney speaking to us from Marquette Prison. I'd now like to welcome Joe Perry, who is a spokesperson for the movement to free the Reverend Edward Pinckney. And Joe, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Margaret. Glad to be on.
Joe, you know, we've been covering here on Sojourner Truth, Reverend Edward Pinckney, what's going on in Benton Harbor, I think likely for all the time we've been on the air. Reverend Pinckney was cut off there. And I'd like for you, Joe, to share with us, for people who are concerned about Reverend Pinckney, about his well-being, who want to support him, who want to be part of the movement to free Reverend Pinckney wrongfully in prison, what should they do, Joe?
Let me just back up for a second and say something. I think that it just hit me, just as you mentioned, that you've been covering Reverend Pinckney's story forever, right? I was actually living in L.A. I'm in Chicago now. I'm from Chicago, but I was living in L.A. in 2009, I believe it was, when I originally heard about it. And I heard about it on your program.
Wow.
That was the first time I ever heard about Reverend Pinckney.
Yeah.
I then moved to Chicago, back to Chicago. And while I was out here, I ran into people who were involved in it. And, you know, I was able to join in, go up to Benton Harbor and, you know, little by little, join the movement. And Reverend Pinckney asked me to be his spokesman. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because here it was on the radio. I first hear about it on your show. And now I'm speaking in an official capacity, you know, for Reverend Pinckney, right? And it kind of gives an example of what other people can do. Now, the whole country isn't hearing about it. Everybody isn't, you know, Margaret Prescott and Sojourner Truth show, right? You guys go to the meat of things and you get the word out. But they've got to keep this thing quiet, and they got to keep it quiet because they're intending to do what they're doing in Benton Harbor all over the entire country. And here you got Reverend Pinckney, who's successfully battling that and successfully turning things around. And yeah, they've got to do things like trump up charges on him, throw him in jail. So the number one thing is to get the word out, because I think that Reverend Pinckney's case speaks for itself. And what the case is all about, it's not about Reverend Pinckney. It's about what they're doing, what corporate Michigan is doing to the people of Benton Harbor and ultimately to everybody in Michigan, and what they're going to be trying to do all over the country. I live in public housing. Public housing here says that they can throw me in jail, arrest me and throw me in jail and no evidence, and throw me out of public housing and make me homeless without any evidence. It says that. It says that officially. So this is something they're attempting to do all over the country. So what we need to do is get the word out about this. And, okay, I'll get my number out. My name is Joseph Perry. My phone number is 312-788-0380 here in Chicago. There's also another spokesperson here, Rob McKay. You can reach him at 312-343-4337. We're willing to go on to radio station, TV, anything. We even have written blogs and sent them out. But to get the word out.
Right.
People can also go to www.bhbanco.org on the internet, and you can contact people who are working around the case. And, of course, doing the things that Banco does there in Benton Harbor, which is all about what Reverend Pinckney had described as going on there in the prison, which is basically you got corporations who are feeding people nasty, rotten, no good food. And also what they're doing in prison is that they're making people work for free. People working for zero.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're a company, if you're a corporation and you've got them, you know, making products for you that you're selling on a market, you literally have not paid anybody any money and you haven't laid out any capital for anything.
Yeah.
Because everything's already paid for and you're making nothing but pure profit.
That's right.
Another aspect of it.
I'm afraid, Joe, we are out of time. We ran a little longer. We wanted to have you on to let people know what they can do to support the Reverend Edward Pinckney. I'm glad you first heard about Pinckney on our show on Sojourner Truth, and we thank you for the work that you are doing in support of him. He's just a great fighter. Thank you so much, Joe Perry.
All right, thank you. All right, bye-bye.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to post the information on what you can do to support the Reverend Edward Pinckney on our social media, on Facebook and other social media. We are now going to turn our attention to what is happening, actually, in the Middle East. Yesterday was Memorial Day in the United States, a day to remember veterans killed in war. Indeed, veterans and their family members on both sides of armed conflict know only too well the suffering resulting from war. The context of this past Memorial Day is the continued loss of life in Iraq and Syria and stepped up U.S. involvement in both countries. Now, to understand the conflicts in the region, one cannot ignore the historic role Western governments played in redrawing borders in the region. And this month marked the 100-year anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which entirely redrew the borders of the Middle East, a move that spurred fighting and bloodshed throughout the region for the past century. Before we introduce our guests and dig deep into this, let's go to a clip now for some of that conflict happening now in Iraq as a fight to take the city of Fallujah from ISIS is underway.
Iraqi tanks rolled down a main road leading into Fallujah, spearheading the all-out push to recapture the city. The offensive to rout ISIS militants began last week, with government forces advancing slowly to try to minimize civilian casualties. Government officials and aid groups estimate at least 50,000 people are trapped in the besieged city. Fallujah, about 40 miles west of Baghdad, is one of the Islamic State's last major strongholds in the region. ISIS has controlled it since 2014. It's being bombarded by Iraqi forces on the ground and the U.S.-led coalition from the air. The city is no stranger to destruction. It was largely ruined in 2004 after the U.S. invasion and subsequent battles with insurgents. Mahar Shmaiteli is the Reuters bureau chief in Baghdad.
The population of Fallujah is a conservative population. It's like an Islamic Sunni conservative, has a Sunni conservative background. Historically, since 2003, since Saddam was toppled, Fallujah was very much like a bastion of the insurgency against first the U.S. occupation of Iraq and later on against the Shiite-led governments that were put in place after the removal of Saddam Hussein.
Thousands have been displaced by the years of fighting, and some have been living in camps for 2 years. They say conditions in the city are desperate. There have been calls for the government to open a safe corridor for the injured, elderly, and children to leave. Iraqi officials say they have to take Fallujah before moving on to Mosul, the country's second largest city.
There you have it. Conflict picking up yet again in Iraq. U.S. troops are on the ground. There's aerial bombardment going on. And across the border, if you look at Syria, we know the crisis that has been going on with Syria with a great loss of life. And also the hundreds, if not thousands of people who have been killed, migrants are trying to escape the region and get to Europe. I'd like to welcome Jim Paul, who is the author of Syria Unmasked. He has served as executive director of the Global Policy Forum, a think tank that monitors the United Nations. He was there for nearly 20 years. He was also a longtime editor of Oxford Companion to Politics of the World and executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. He earned his bachelor's degree cum laude from Harvard, his master's from Oxford University in the UK, and his PhD from New York University. Dr. Jim Paul, welcome.
Yeah, nice to be with you.
Okay, so Jim Paul, yesterday, Memorial Day, looking at the conflict happening in Iraq, in Syria, indeed, throughout the region. You heard reference there to the Sunni-Shia conflict. Interestingly, now in Iraq, you've got Iraqi troops trained, some trained by the government of Iran and the U.S. doing an aerial bombardment. So it's kind of a interesting coming together there between the United States and Iran. But let's go back a little bit and look at the redrawing of the map in the Mideast and the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Tell our listeners, what was the Sykes-Picot Agreement?
The area was ruled by the Ottoman Empire, which had its capital in Turkey, in Istanbul, and it was quite a large area that included most of the Levant area, in other words, going all the way out through Iraq, what was known as Mesopotamia in those days, and down into Syria, and at one time even a considerable chunk of North Africa. So the Western European powers were keen to overthrow the Ottoman Empire, and during World War I, the Ottomans joined the Germans and Austria-Hungarian Empire in that war, and so the victory of the Allies over that alliance with the Ottomans led to the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire. The West was very keen, Western Europeans were very keen to dismember the empire because they wanted to seize those countries that had been formerly under Ottoman control. And so during the war, while the war was still being fought in the spring of 1916, two diplomats, one from Britain and one from France, Mr. Sykes and Monsieur Picot, got together to discuss on behalf of their governments how the region would be distributed between Britain and France in the post-war period. And so they drew some lines on maps, and those lines had to do with their own imperial interests. They had nothing whatsoever to do with the people on the ground.
Yeah.
The Russians were the third member of that alliance, but they didn't get the chance to say anything much about this. So that we see is the origins, but not the final determination of many of the borders in the modern Middle East.
Well, let me ask you this, Jim Paul, because even before the war was won, during World War I itself, these two allied powers, which was then called Great Britain, that recently have dropped the great of late, and France, they were secretly already discussing and agreeing how they were going to divide up the region. And clearly the resources in the region and the possible economic gain had something to do with it. And what the reason Russia wasn't part of it in the end is that they had a revolution in Russia. And when the Bolsheviks won, they sort of exposed this agreement and they were not part of it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. I mean, they were certainly divided in this plan, which was signed on May 16th, 1916, was a result of, you know, quite a few months of negotiation. The Russians didn't have much power before the revolution to get into the game, so they more or less let Britain and France do it. But yes, you're right, it was very interesting. Very, very soon after the revolution, 1917, the Bolshevik government released the secret documents and so made it clear what had been going on. The Allies, we should point out, Britain in particular, made all sorts of promises to the Arabs. If you help us in the war, this was Lawrence of Arabia and that whole story that we know, made promises that they were going to be an independent Arab state that would be a large and strong state in the region. That's what they wanted. That's what the Arabs wanted. But in fact, the British didn't carry through with that. They were planning to divide up, and of course there was the Balfour Declaration that promised Palestine as a home to the Jews. So there were all sorts of things that were happening, different stories that were being told to different parties and so on. So it's very useful to reflect on all this now. It seems like a long time ago, 100 years, but in fact it's not just the borders that were being drawn, but in my opinion, more importantly, it has to do with the behavior of the Western powers and how they were constantly talking about international law, respect for the people, making promises and so forth, whereas in fact they were dividing it up based on their imperial interests. And I think when we look at present-day situation, yes, it's useful to reflect on the problems that were created by the borders that were drawn, but it's most important to understand the fact that these powers that are still at work there, still, you know, even talking about changing borders and so forth, that their inspiration and their purpose is not doesn't have anything to do with the well-being of the people in the region.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, too, because even after Sykes-Picot was exposed and with the Russians originally, they were, quote unquote, given Istanbul, the Turkish Straits and Armenia, but had to withdraw likely when the Russian Revolution heated up. But meanwhile, that treaty, Sykes-Picot, was upheld by the League of Nations back in 1922. And it reminds me of the UN several decades later holding up the removal of Palestinian people from Palestine, right, and creating the state of Israel. But the way this also plays itself out is that there were specific tribes in that area. They had completely different lines of demarcations, and we still see some of that reflected in the conflicts of today. I mean, I think a similar thing likely happened on the continent of Africa, where you had different nations, right? And then you had Western powers coming in, colonial powers, and dividing it up as they pleased, you know what I mean, to serve themselves and not really basing it too much on the indigenous people who lived there and who had for thousands of years. Jim Paul.
That's very much correct. But when we come down to thinking about the specifics of borders and what is a just border and what is a, you know, how should a state be constructed, it gets us into a thorny terrain because, you know, what really should a state look like and what should its people, who should be living within it and so on. I want to make it clear that what I'm talking about is the problem of the assumption of, which was very powerful in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that states should somehow, especially new states, should somehow be reflect a homogeneity of peoples within them.
Yeah.
And the problem with this idea is that usually, even in relatively homogeneous areas, there are other people with different, let's say, religious beliefs, languages, cultural traditions, and so forth, that live there. And so when you start slicing up, and then you get a, then there's people inside that sliced up area that was supposed to be, you know, absolutely pure, that it turns out that they have their concern also about the oppression that they might be experiencing in a new state.
Yeah.
So, for instance, Kurdistan is the one that's most in the news these days, and a lot of people think that an independent Kurdistan should be carved out of, you know, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And, you know, there certainly are quite a few Kurds who would like to see this happen, and I'm just sounding a warning that creating new states doesn't always create, you know, a good situation on the ground, and that there are sometimes minorities who are oppressed within those new states. For example, Kurdistan in the north of Iraq, there's quite a few different ethnic minorities that live there, and that are not Kurds and don't see themselves as Kurds and so forth. And so, actually, in Iraq, the Iraqi Kurds have taken a position that they would, or many groups, the most influential groups have taken a position that they should be part, a federated part of Syria going forward. And because Syria is a very, very diverse country. And if we start carving up, we give a piece to the Kurds, we give a piece to the Alawites, we give a piece to the Druze and so forth, we're really in trouble. The United States may feel it can control better the oil situation, as the case of Peter Galbraith shows us very well. He made $300 million, a former U.S. diplomat who was supporting Kurdish independence, wrote the Iraqi constitution in such a way that it would allow the oil companies to get in there.
We're going to have to wrap up very shortly, but just to say what you're talking about, you know, the division, I mean, even in back in 2006, it was Biden who, as a senator, who talked for a soft partition in Iraq along ethnic lines, Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish, but also historically, again, putting this in the historic context, I mean, the French had put the minority Christians in charge of Lebanon, as part of keeping down the majority Sunnis and Shiites. And then they also recruited in Syria the Alawite Shiites in Syria to head up the army that ruled over the majority Sunnis, right? And the British installed a Sunni king in Iraq to rule over the country's majority Shiites. And in Palestine, we see, you know, what has been happening there. So it's almost like a repeat of history, or an attempt of a repeat of history. And I think you're quite right to sound the alarm here. So just final thoughts on from you on this entire situation. Jim Paul.
Yeah, well, I just to circle back to saying watch out for what the, you know, what the U.S. and its Western allies are saying they want to do in the interest of the people in the region. In the interest of peace, they say, in the interest of democracy, they say, and so on.
Yeah.
I think the first thing we have to do is to assume that if they're saying that, there's probably something different going on, and we have to be very careful. And there's a three-letter word that explains a lot of what's going on, and that word is oil. And if the principal powers are interested in controlling oil resources in the region, and so when they start talking about freedom for the Kurds and this and that and the other, a lot of well-meaning people, including a lot of people on the left, start to say, oh yes, we have to do something for the Kurds, we got to create a state for the Kurds and so forth. Be careful, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and also there's the issue of security for Israel. You mentioned destabilizing Israel's neighbors, quite useful. We're going to have to continue this discussion, Jim Paul. There's a lot to uncover here, but we appreciate you joining us and for your insight and your work. Thank you, Dr. Jim Paul.
Thank you, Margaret.
We are going to take a short station break, and coming up, trouble in the Democratic National Committee as the chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is coming increasingly under fire. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
People, my people are dying, and we see it all the time. Don't know where our future would be if he's not here. How do we stay strong?
And the song My People by Angie Stone featuring James Ingram. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, you can check us out on the SoundCloud website. Also on our website, www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook, spread the word. We are now going to turn our attention to trouble within the Democratic National Committee as its chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, is coming under fire. Now, the campaign of Bernie Sanders, the latest poll that I've heard shows him just 2 percentage points behind in California. Bernie winning California would be huge, as Bernie would say, and certainly would shake things up as we go into the Democratic Party convention in Philadelphia in July. Also, Bernie Sanders, he beats Trump in the national polls in a matchup between Trump and Sanders. Sanders wins handily in some instances by double digits, while the gap between Trump and Hillary is narrowing. A couple of polls showing actually Trump winning, but other polls are showing a 2 percentage point difference between Hillary and Donald Trump. Meanwhile, some Sanders supporters and others have been critical of the the Democratic National Committee and its head, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And we'll find out more about that and why. We'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Howie Klein. He blogs at downwithtyranny.blogspot.com. He's closely followed the career of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and he's a retired music executive. His career included a dozen years as president of Reprise Records. Howie Klein, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Good morning, Margaret.
So, Howie, there's now this petition signed by scores of people. I read somewhere it was 40,000 signatures, remove Debbie Wasserman Schultz as DNC chair. What are the reasons petitioners are giving for wanting to remove her?
Well, there are a few reasons, and they're almost two separate things. So one has to do with her performance as a congresswoman, and the other has to do with her performance as the chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee.
Well, let's start with that, the DNC.
Okay, so as chair of the DNC, although keep in mind that before she was the chair of the DNC, she had been one of the chairmen of the Hillary Clinton for President campaign in 2008. So when Hillary Clinton was running against Obama, first Debbie Wasserman Schultz was the chairman of her Florida committee, and then she was co-chair of her national committee. So she comes into the DNC chairmanship with a very biased view in favor of Hillary Clinton, and many people, not just Bernie fans, but also unbiased observers, saw that she seemed to be positioning the debates in such a way as she thought would help Hillary. So, in other words, to give less exposure to Bernie Sanders. Remember, Hillary Clinton is a household name; everybody knows who she is. She doesn't need that kind of exposure. Whereas Bernie was not a well-known person, so Wasserman Schultz, and there are even people who were on the DNC, one of whom, Tulsi Gabbard, a congresswoman from Hawaii, who quit over this. She started scheduling the very, very few debates and awkward times, like against championship basketball games and things that would hold down the viewership. So that got people angry. Then there were a whole series of things that she did, some very, very small, some very large, like keeping Bernie Sanders' campaign from accessing his own election data, that which is stored by the DNC for free, but she cut him off from his own data. So which is a very, very, very serious thing. And she would, you know, do little things like go to the media and make these absurd claims that there was some sort of a riot of Bernie fans throwing chairs around in Nevada. That never happened. That was just her. That was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the classic Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So the idea that she would be the representative of the Democratic Party, someone who's supposed to bring unity to the Democratic Party, was absurd. I mean, she behaved much worse than her Republican counterpart, Reince Priebus. We may not like what he stands for or the candidates he represents, but at all times, he tried very, very hard to be unbiased between them.
Well, let me ask you this, too, because our guest is Howie Klein here, who blogs at downwithtyranny.blogspot.com, and we're discussing the Democratic National Committee and its chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I mean, people likely forgot that she was part of the Hillary for President campaign against Barack Obama, you know, actually. And recently, Hillary refused to debate Bernie in the lead up to this crucial vote happening next week in California. And that's upset a lot of people. I must say, I really thought that was, pretty outrageous on Hillary's part. But the number of debates have also been controversial. And as you say, Hillary has been running for president for how long now? From even before Barack Obama started to run. And so she's had all all of that exposure, as you say, and people are only in many ways now getting to know Bernie. And as they know Bernie, he goes up. I mean, nobody expected Bernie's campaign to be where it is right now. So, but tell us about this thing about the limiting the number of debates as well.
Well, of course, it was thought that the fewer debates there would be, the less of a chance Bernie would have to present himself, not to people who, you know, live and breathe politics, but to casual Democrats, passive Democrats, who usually don't tune in until later. I mean, I've been following Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders went to my high school and to my elementary school in Brooklyn.
Really?
Bernie Sanders forever. But I know that I'm in a tiny minority. People, you know, he's some senator from Vermont. People don't know who he is. But as they get to know him, as you just said, they think, wow, his ideas, his positions, the things that he's done historically and the things that he's advocating are just exactly what I like. There are lots and lots of people saying that. So Debbie Wasserman Schultz took it on herself to make sure that as few people as possible would find that out by scheduling fewer debates and by scheduling them at awkward times and making sure that it was just the opposite of what the Republicans were doing. The Republicans were trying to get as many debates and as big an audience as possible, while Debbie Wasserman Schultz did everything she could to get as small an audience as possible. But there is another part of this that's important that people shouldn't forget. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, in representing the Democratic Party, is representing not the values and principles of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and Bernie Sanders. She's representing the values and principles of a new kind of Democratic Party. In fact, she's a member of something called the New Dems, similar to New Labour in England, which is a much more business-friendly rather than worker-friendly party. You know, she is the representative of, for example, private prisons. She is a representative of payday lenders. That's who she gets her money from. So should she really be the head of the Democratic Party on TV?
Yeah, and to underscore your point, there's an article in The Hill today that says Sanders supporters have a point. And the author, David Russell, I think is his name, has said that the problem with Clinton is that she's a dino, Democrat in name only, and that the core values, and I'm just quoting this, of the Democratic Party in the 1990s were trashed under Hillary's husband, under Bill, and threw workers under the proverbial bus, and that they essentially became kind of Republicans. I mean, these sort of blue dog Democrats. And what has happened under Obama is that the Democratic Party has shifted away from that more to the left, right, than certainly the blue dog Democrats and Hillary had hoped for. And there were 26 debates, Democratic Party debates, presidential debates in 2008, and only 9 this year. And they even had to fight over that 9 because originally only 6 were scheduled. So, by the way, also this petition is, we are talking about, as mentioned, put out by RootsAction.org, and that's the co-founder of RootsAction.org, of course, is Norman Solomon. But a final word from you, Howie Klein.
Well, my main word is that it's I love Norman, and he's one of many. His organization is one of many that put out petitions to get her to resign. She will never resign. She'll have to be dragged out of there. Bernie has already said he would fire her if he becomes the nominee of the party. But the real way to go after Debbie Wasserman Schultz isn't to get her to resign from the DNC. The real way to go after her is to support her opponent, Tim Canova, who's running the first primary ever against her in her Florida congressional district. And he's raised over $1.5 million, and she's never had a primary opponent. She doesn't know how to fight a primary opponent. and there's a good chance of getting her out of Congress altogether, which would be a much better thing than just getting her out of the DNC.
Right. Well, as of this morning, 44,000 people have signed the petition asking for her removal. So we'll have to see how much the power of the people, the impact of the power of the people, and what happens in July at the convention. Bernie has already said it's a bit of a mess, and there's been a lot of debate about exactly what that means. But we're going to keep watching this and stay posted. Keep us posted on your work. And thank you so much for joining us, Howie Klein. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret.
All righty. We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers. Sherelle, thank you so very much. Our assistant producer, Stephanie Case. Our engineer today, Federico Garcia. You can follow us on Twitter at So True Radio. You can become our Facebook friend. Look for Sojourner Truth and follow our news coverage all day long at www.sotrueradio.org. Audio is also available at archive.org. Search for Sojourner Truth. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.